Right, good morning, everyone. It's a real delight to be here and to think the first Catholic after 6 years. So, maybe the last after my talk. But it's really nice to be here. Thank you so much for the invites and the hospitality to Tim, to Bob, and to Linda, who isn't here. And a very special welcome to Sixth Formers. It's absolute delight to have kind of that interest from a new generation, because the future of theology is in your hands, no pressure. And I look forward to the session we have later on together. Just a few sort of announcements, if I may. Number one, I promised the bookstall person that I would advertise the fact that my book is there. So if you're a kind of serious insomniac, this is the answer to your problems. Or if you just like reading telephone directories and things like that, you love my book. It's sort of apparently at a very reduced price, which shocked me when I looked at it. But it is cheaper than the other book that I asked them to have here, which is the work of Michael Wishkorod, who's an Orthodox Jewish thinker. And his work is fantastically interesting, and it has a preface by a Christian who's very affected by Michael's work. So two particular books that connect up with this talk, I apologize that they're more expensive than I would wish. The other little bit of is I'm on a kind of program connected with my university, which is trying to prove that academics aren't a waste of time. And what it requires is for me to get some feedback from you. So if after the talk you haven't fallen asleep and you think, oh, well, I liked it just a little, I'd be so grateful if you were to put your email on a sheet of paper at the back, just near the reception. Promise you it won't be sold for thousands to lots of various groups. But it will mean I can get in touch with you and just ask you to fill in a brief questionnaire. And the benefit of it will be that hopefully it'll mean that kind of academics working in arts fields can be said to be worthwhile in some way, and that they do address and connect up with a wider public. So if you have an email, I'd be very grateful. Promise you full confidentiality. And in the break, there's a sheet of paper. Last bit is that you've got this sheet of paper that I've given you here, texts for Gavin's talk. And I won't be asking you to look at it during the talk, but it's more for you to take home and say, oh, did he really claim that? And here's the evidence, so you can have a look at it. Okay, so a slight context then. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I work with a Vatican group that are connected with this issue, and I'm actually writing a book on this matter from a Catholic standpoint. So number one, I'm going to present to you issues that have arisen for the Catholic Church's thinking and praxis on this matter. This is not meant unecumenically. It's just that each and every church is going through a different kind of process and at a different speed. We always are terribly slow, let me say. Take 100 years longer than anyone else to get there. But then it's a large group with a lot of consultation, etc. So I just wanted to share with you a picture of what's going on in Catholic thinking, and also to share with you as a theologian myself, the kind of problems or exciting sorts of issues that arise. Okay, so my talk is divided into three parts. The first part, designed to finish within 10 minutes, will be an introduction to the topic. Second part, 15 minutes, will be looking at one question, which I think is absolutely gripping and interesting and puzzling. And then the last part, for another 15 minutes, we'll look at a second question. So there are two questions and an introduction. And I've asked for a longer question and answer, because to be honest, it's quite boring listening to myself. I mean, for me, not for you, I hope. And I'm very, very keen to just get feedback and engagement. And so we can discuss matters from whatever kind of perspective you're coming from, etc. Okay. So just a bit of a background. After the Second World War, as Bob has said, there was a kind of remarkable rethinking in Christian circles connected with the fact that a third of world Jewry had been exterminated in the heart of Christian Europe. Hitler was a baptized Catholic in Germany. The majority of people were either Lutheran or Catholic. There are famous stories of how the camp guards would go to mass or to a Sunday service and then return to their jobs of exterminating the Jewish people. And the question arose after the war, what is the role of Christian theology and Christian culture in anti-Jewishness? And the World Council of Churches, large groups began to come to a rereading of St. Paul, especially Romans, which looks at the enduring covenant that God has made with the Jewish people. And Romans 11:29 calls it irrevocable. God does not go back on his promises. So kind of interesting thing when you're in such a hierarchical, pyramidal power church as I am. If the Pope decides something needs to be done, then it usually does get set into motion. And John the 23rd, who was Pope in the 60s, was involved as a diplomat in Hungary, a papal diplomat, in terms of actually getting escape visas for Jewish people, often pretending that they were Catholic to get them out of Europe, housing them in churches, and creating part of an escape route through Hungary. So John the 23rd, before he became Pope, was very, very involved in the Jewish issue. When he became Pope, there is a very famous meeting he had with the Jewish historian Jules Isaac. And Isaac said to John, "You can't change Christian doctrine, I fully respect that. But there is one thing in Christianity that, if it was changed, would help dismantle the anti-Jewish heritage. And that was the charge of deicide, that the Jews were guilty of, allegedly. And going back to the biblical verse, 'Let his blood be upon us and our children,' the whole of the Jewish race." And Isaac said, "If that can be clarified, that it is not the whole of the Jewish people who are guilty, that is all I ask of you." Now, there are actually papers released from the Vatican that after the meeting with Isaac, John XXIII said to Cardinal Beer, who was in charge of ecumenical relations, to draft a document for the Second Vatican Council that would address the issue of deicide and the Jews. So in 1964, 1965, the Catholic Church made an incredible shift in its cultural ethos of, well, number one, saying that while the Bible clearly speaks of Jewish people involved in the death of Jesus, not all Jews can be claimed to be guilty. In fact, the Catechism of Trent had already said that, but it hadn't affected church culture. In fact, the Tridentine Catechism had come up with this wonderful insight that Christians are more guilty for the death of Jesus because they knew who he was, and when they sin, they say no to him. Whereas citing biblical material, it is quite possible that many of the folk involved in this did not know who he was. leave that aside, the primary, if you like, responsibility is actually on those who know. Second change in the Vatican Council, and these documents are binding on all Catholics. So when you folk have good arguments, you go to the Bible. When we have good arguments, we go to the Bible and we go to church councils and official teachings. Okay, so the second important change was pointing out that Jesus was a Jew, which actually we all know now. You wouldn't have thought it needed a church council to tell you this. And that Mary and the apostles were Jewish, which actually was quite a significant moment. This all happened in 64-65. Big question in Catholic thought was, okay, that's okay, but can one apply Romans 11:29 to contemporary Judaism? Because Paul was referring to biblical Judaism, and in effect, many Jewish folks said, well, great that you've done this, but living Judaism is a fossil in this document. So everything changed in 1980, and this is really getting to the thick of the plot. In 1980, John Paul II used the phrase from Paul, Romans 11:29, that the gifts and the promises are irrevocable, and applied it in Germany at a synagogue to Jewish hearers, showing that there was an understanding that the covenant that was spoken of by Paul was actually in existence with Jewish people today. So after 1980, Catholic teaching on the matter goes really fast forward, because that's the big breakthrough. Up until then, there was much dispute as to whether this was applicable to contemporary Judaism. John Paul II repeated this teaching 8 times. Pope Benedict repeated it 3 times. Pope Francis repeated it 3 times. Now, this is just to say that if a lot of popes repeat the same thing, this slowly gets more and more authority, and you can't say, oh, well, he had a bad day. This is becoming established teaching. Okay, so the introduction is to say, at the moment, Catholic thought is now firmly off the view that the covenant made with the Jewish people, i.e. contemporary Jewish people, is irrevocable and from God, because God does not go back on his promises. What implications does this have in 2 areas? And these are the 2 areas I want to look at. What implication does it have, area number one, for the claim by the Catholic Church that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life? Salvation only comes through Christ. Now, there, I think we join hands with all Orthodox Christian churches, and then Catholics and some Protestants add a little extra, which say, and he founded this church so to mediate his message. So that there is no salvation without Christ mediated through his sacramental church. At the same time as saying there is an irrevocable covenant made with the Jewish people. Right? See the tension? It's an interesting one. So the first question I want to look at, and when you're at home, this is the quote I'm going to read you, is from GIFS, which is a document published in 2015, which very starkly brings up the implication of the issue. It says, quote, that the Jews are participants in God's salvation is theologically unquestionable. But how that can be possible without confessing Christ explicitly is and remains an unfathomable divine mystery. Now, you've got to have your kind of warning bells on when people say unfathomable divine mystery. It could mean that there's just a contradiction that's not going to hold, and one invokes immediately paradox, divine mystery, etc. But it brings to a head, and it's quite remarkable, within 50 years of Vatican II, the recognition that saying the Jewish covenant is irrevocable must mean that God wills it, and if God wills it, it must have a role in salvation. And at the same time, but how can that be possible without confessing Christ explicitly? Unfathomable mystery. Okay, so I'm going to try and unpack the unfathomable mystery and make it actually no less mysterious, because of course Paul talks about it being part of the mystery, but actually try and make sense of that tension. And I want to do it in two moves. The first move, and let me just change my page. The first move is to notice that throughout the tradition, and I now speak of, again, a shared tradition here, there is an interesting exception that is allowed for those who do not know Christ through no fault of their own. Right, so remember that phrase, through no fault of their own. There are many people who do not know Christ through no fault of their own. And in the 15th and 16th century, this came home very dramatically with the expansion of missions to Latin America. And there were discovered whole groups of people who just never heard the gospel. Now, it's quite interesting. If one looks at Thomas Aquinas, he speculates about people who may never have heard of the gospel. And you know what the example he gives? It's wonderful. It tells you about his time and expectation. He takes the example of the wolf child, a child brought up in the forest by wolves and has no human contact. Lots of them we know. And Thomas says, would a good God leave this child without any sense of the possibility of salvation? And Thomas answers it, no, God couldn't do that. Despite the person being in sin, God's goodness would mean he would reach out to the child in the forest. He wouldn't make the wolves talk, not necessary. He would either have an interior revelation or God would send an angel to the child. This was Thomas's answer. Now, the important bit is that Thomas was making it clear that there would not be a situation where a person did not have a chance to respond to the gospel. Of course, with the discovery of the New World in the 15th, 16th century, it became a dramatically pressing question. It wasn't just the child in the forest, it was swathes of people in civilization who had never heard the gospel. And quite interestingly, it was missionaries on the one hand who developed the idea that if a person didn't accept the gospel, they lost their civil rights and could be made into slaves under the King of Spain's ruling. So some of the missionaries happily read the gospel in Latin to large groups of Native American Indians and then said, do you convert to the true church? And when they said, where's the tea? What's happening? They were actually made into slaves because they had rejected the gospel. Now, it was other missionaries who pointed out these people never rejected it. They just had no idea, partly because they didn't understand Latin. And the other interesting thing, partly because of the behavior of the missionaries. So there was this wonderful internal critique. And I'm wanting to say there has always been an idea within Christian thought that those who do not know the gospel through no fault of their own will have a means offered them. So this is not radically new. Second point. The early church had the question posed to them, what about great-grandfather Josiah or great-grandmother Anna? Jews who lived before the time of Jesus, were they lost? You can imagine the kind of tension for Jewish followers of Jesus who were saying, no salvation outside of Christ, and yet all their relatives and great patriarchs and matriarchs in the church had gone before. And the early church came up with an interesting solution, which is contested. But the solution was to argue that Jesus' descent into the underworld, as the creed says on the third day before he rises, he descends into, it's called hell, but technically it's not hell. It is the, if you like, underworld. So that he may preach, following the reference in Peter, 1 Peter, to those who are in prison. And you get beautiful icons of the descent of Jesus into the underworld, if you like, opening the gates, and out comes Moses and all of the great figures of faith. But you can also notice in iconography some of the Greek philosophers are there, waiting to be redeemed. Okay, so third and final point, the Jewish people. One way in which the tension can be resolved is this, and really I'd love to hear whether you think this is rubbish, not convincing, and, you know, I really need to put my thinking hat on again, which, of course, is always the case, is to argue that Jewish rites were willed by God. The testament, the gifts and the promises were given by God to the Jewish people, his people. Therefore, all Jewish rites and practices rightly point towards the Messiah. And the efficacy of such rites and practices derive from Jesus Christ, who is the Jewish Messiah. Okay, so here goes the argument. Number one, you have to assume that modern-day Jews who say no to Christianity are doing this in good faith, i.e., horrible technical term, they're invincibly ignorant of the truth, i.e., they don't know Jesus is the Messiah, and so they follow in their hearts and in their conscience what God has given them. If technically a Jewish person said, yes, I know Jesus is the Messiah in my heart, in my mind, but I don't like it and don't want to believe it, then we have a real technical problem of sin. Otherwise, I want to suggest that the history of Christian treatment to Jews is such that most Jews rightly cannot see Christianity for them. It actually means their extinction. Therefore, the efficacy of Jewish rites, and this is very uncomfortable to say face to face to a Jewish person, but this is what I think theology drives at, the efficacy of their rites derive from Jesus Christ, and therefore the church still teaches that all salvation comes through Christ. But in this instance, implicitly, at the level of Jewish folks not yet confessing. So besides this problem being developed and thought through like that, it contains all sorts of difficulties. It contains the difficulty of actually sharing this type of outlook with Jewish folk. So when I've done so in terms of discussion, they say, oh, thanks. It's great to know that my religion is only meaningful because of your God. And I think my response to it usually is, well, the Noahide covenant, so graciously developed in Judaism, is an equivalent of what I'm saying, i.e., it is your Jewish God dealing with the Gentiles through this covenant, which is, in a sense, necessary for any religious thought to make sense of the other. A second issue is that this doesn't mean that Judaism is only valuable as a religion in waiting to become Christianity. Definitely not. Its practices must reflect the ways of God such that we can learn from the Jewish people. But it also leaves us with a really sticky question, which I hate to think about thinking about. And that is, what forms of Judaism actually enact the covenant given by God? So that if you look at contemporary Judaism, there's huge internal debate, such that many Orthodox Jews say of liberal Jews, they've lost the picture. They are not actually halakhic, law-abiding Jews. And then those Orthodox Jews get told by the ultra-Orthodox Jews, you ain't right either, guys, because you are not taking the practice fully. So although this is kind of like thinking this is a breakthrough for Christian thought, it's actually an entree into a can of worms. But I think it's a can that has to be opened and thought about. Last problem, and then I'll get to my second question. In Catholic thought, and this is the other document I quote, Dominus Iesus, Jesus Christ is Lord, it is clearly taught, and this is a high-level teaching, right, that there can be no other religion de jure that is salvific. De jure is a technical term to contrast with de facto, i.e., God wills de jure, God permits de facto. Right, don't worry if you don't get this, but it's actually quite interesting. So Dominus Iesus says, there can be no other salvific religion de jure apart from the Christian Church. All other religions, in so much as they may have elements of truth, goodness, and light, are used de facto by God. So I want to say there's a real problem for Catholic theologians, because the teaching on the one hand about the Jews is implying a de jure status in that statement, the Jews are participants in God's salvation, not a de facto status. Okay, so exciting times ahead. If you want to be a theologian, especially you guys at the back, this is the time to do it, because there are so many questions that need reflection. But that's an attempt to look at one of the issues. The second issue I want to look at, question number two, is totally, explicitly ignored by the Catholic magisterium. And this is the question of the land. And one can see why it's ignored as soon as you start thinking about it. What I want to do is set a proposal before you to get your feedback, and a proposal that I've been going up and down the land in Catholic circles putting forward, which is for what I call a minimalist Catholic Zionism, right? And it, you know, if there are cans of worms around, God's great at opening cans of worms, it seems to me. This is a big one. So before I put the proposal to you, I want to make three kind of health warnings. So you mustn't misunderstand my proposal in these three ways. Number one, the proposal can in no way call into question the right of Palestinians to a homeland. Being a minimalist Catholic Zionism is not trampling on the head of Palestinians. The Vatican, in 2000 and in 2015, have signed agreements with the Palestinian Authority and with the PLO, recognizing two things. Number one, that the Palestinian people must have a right and just full settlement. And secondly, and this causes a lot of problems in Israel, the recognition of a Palestinian state. And this was in tandem with the Vatican having an agreement with Israel, recognizing its legal jurisdiction as a country with international legality, and secondly, its right to exist, and thirdly, exchanging diplomatic relationships. So the Vatican has been really, really careful, no step towards the Jewish state unless it's in tandem with the Palestinian cause. There are Palestinian Catholics and Middle Eastern Catholics and Christians on the ground who have got a lot of vested concern in these issues. So number one, no compromise on that. Number two, minimalist Catholic Zionism does not underwrite any particular government or ruling group in Israel. It is not an attempt, as Jerry Falwell put it, to defend Israel is to defend God. It is not an unwritten check saying okay to the government. Thirdly, it is no recognition or agreement with boundary disputes. Okay, so I want to say that what I'm proposing doesn't attempt to enter into those three questions. You might say, you can't propose it then, Gavin. Come on, you're talking nonsense. Well, probably I am. But I'm wanting to say there is movement here. Okay, so those are the three qualifiers. What's the positive evidence? Now, the positive evidence is really fascinating, and I draw from, again, Vatican documents to indicate what I think is a basic position emerging in the Roman Catholic Church, which cannot be taken because of the political irresolution in the country. Personally, I think the bullet must be bitten, and we, as a community, need to be loyal to theology, first and foremost, and not politics and diplomacy. I can happily say that because I don't live in Israel. But I think, in a way, there's a challenge to the Catholic Church to come out and be counted. And those of you who are Anglicans will be intrigued to know that your own church right now in the Faith and Order Commission is coming up with a document related specifically on this area. Very, very exciting, interesting moves in the Anglican Church. Okay, so the three points I want to make. Number one, the Pontifical Biblical Commission, which is, if you like, the high-level authority, biblical experts appointed by the Vatican, came out with a finding, and this is in your handout, okay? So just believe me for the moment, and then you can read the text. Arguing that on historical critical grounds, there can be no question that in the Old Testament, God promises a land to his people, the Jews. The land is an unconditional promise, but it makes ethical, religious demands upon the people. Number one, to live justly. Number two, to be hospitable to the stranger. Number three, to be a light to the nations. It then looks, and this is the really intriguing bit, and actually probably Bob knows far more than at least I know on this issue. It then looks at the New Testament and it says, what does the New Testament teach about the land? Well, you'll see in your handout, it sort of says, well, we have a great fondness, we have a important attachment, blah, blah, which is very important. It's actually a kind of, if you like, a quasi-sacramental area. I don't mean to be offensive to those of you who come from traditions where you might find that difficult. But the section on the New Testament ends with saying specifically and explicitly, the New Testament does not call into question the promise made to the Jewish people. That's the important bit for me. So I think the document's quite inadequate about the Old about the New Testament theology, but importantly, it leaves intact the promises made by God to the Jewish people, and quite rightly, it leaves unanswered whether those promises apply to present-day Israel or not. But that's the biblical point number one. Point number two. In various documents which are quoted here, 1969, the unpublished document, which is a bit of a weak argument, isn't it? Here I'm going to argue from a document that doesn't exist. But actually, it's very interesting, this document, right? So in 1969, the Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews produced a draft of this document. The draft was leaked by an American cardinal, because American cardinals know that if something is going to be sat on, the best way is to leak it, and then no one can sit on it. That's exactly what happened at Vatican II. The document on the Jewish people that I just mentioned was sat on. It was too politically dangerous. How did the world come to find out? An American cardinal leaked it to the New York Times, that published it. Absolute storm about it, and the Vatican realized they couldn't pretend they weren't doing it, and they had to move forward. So this was the same thinking. This document in 69, and it's really remarkable, acknowledges that the land created in Israel, as Israel, is connected with God's promises. That's how many religious Jewish people understand it. Not all. And in fact, initially, Zionism was a very secular movement. But it acknowledges that many religious Jews understand the land as part of the identity of the Jewish people. It then says, and Christians need to take this on seriously. It doesn't say Christians must accept this as a theological claim. But it's shocking when you think in 1969, historically, this is just after the war, actually saying this claim must be taken seriously by the churches. Well, although it was leaked, it never made the surface again. And interestingly, when I was researching this, looking at the Vatican archives, the copy of the document that they have doesn't correspond to the leaked New York Times document. So even the trace of that document has disappeared. Intriguing. But very explicable, because 69 was a difficult time to say anything in public from the Vatican's point of view. In 85, we get another document that repeats the same major teachings. The Jewish people's existence today is a sign of God's care for them, that they haven't been annihilated. Then it specifically speaks about the hope of the land found in the Old Testament, affirming it. And then, very delicately, and if you want kind of great diplomatic juggling, the Vatican is the place to look for it, it says, Israel, the country, shows God's providence to be at work because there the Jewish people are safe. So number one, and here's minimalist Catholic Zionism, Israel is connected with God's providence. It's not just a legal decision. It's not just a matter of international law. And secondly, when the fundamental agreement was being signed with Israel, so this document I'm quoting in 85 is before the Vatican, in fact, diplomatically recognized the existence of Israel. So this group, the Commission for Religious Relations with Jews, are like the fast lane of thinking. And then the center lane is the main curia, the magisterium and the central body of thinking. So when the central body of thinking comes to recognize the state of Israel in terms of the fundamental agreement in 1993, the text begins, very interestingly, by saying this text is connected with the state of Israel, but it recognizes the religious significance of the text. That's all it says. And this is really interesting because the Vatican has diplomatic relationships with 145 different countries. And in none of those does it say there is a religious significance to the relationship. It is understood as purely diplomatic. So these are all like little straws in the wind. But what I want to suggest, and I close with this, is that if the Church, the Catholic Church, is going to accept that the promises and the gifts are irrevocable, it has to take seriously the claim about the land. It can reject it. It can actually say, we must remain neutral towards it, but it cannot ignore the theological claim that is being generated. So I want to suggest that there is such a thing called minimalist Catholic Zionism, which sees in the ingathering of the Jewish people the hand of God. I do not want to make a claim like some Christian Zionists, and I think there's a complex argument to be had, that this is the beginning of the end times. It could be that Israel has returned and will be expelled again. I hope not. It could be that there will be much travail. But there has to be a judgment about God's activity in history, and I'm suggesting there's enough evidence to say, here it is, it counts. Okay, so 1 minute to 11, I've kept my time. I do really invite questions from whatever perspective. I do apologize for quoting Vatican documents at a non-Catholic or predominantly non-Catholic audience. I don't quote them with any sense that they have a hold or authority on you. It's more sharing in a kind of Christian brotherly and sisterly way, a journey that is taking place. And over the 15 minutes that you have, besides breathing again and going, we're finished, please remember, if you in the least could help me and put your email there, that would be great. If you don't, you're a friend for life, whatever. Please don't worry or feel pressure. Or if you're like my wife, who doesn't actually use email yet, you're forgiven. But thank you so much for your attention, and I look forward to seeing you in 15 minutes.